Oh yay, oh yay, oh yay. The Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas. All persons having business before the Honorable, the Supreme Court of Texas, are admonished to draw near and give their attention, for the court is now sitting. God save the state of Texas and this honorable court.
Thank you. Be seated, please. Good morning. The court has three matters on its oral submission docket. In the order of their appearance, they are docket number 100426, Safe Shred Inc. versus Luis Martinez III from Travis County and the 3rd Court of Appeals District. 100429, Shell Oil Company and others versus Ralph Ross from Harris County and the 1st Court of Appeals District. And 10435, Weeks Marine Inc. versus Maximino Garza from Starr County and the 4th Court of Appeals District. The court has allotted 20 minutes per side for each of these arguments, and we will take a brief recess between them. Justice Willett is participating in all three arguments. He should be here by the second argument this morning. These proceedings are being recorded, and a link to the arguments will be posted to the court's website by the end of the day today. The court is ready to hear argument in the first matter, 100426, Safe Shred Inc. versus Luis Martinez III.
May I please the court? Mr. Morgan will present argument for petitioner. Petitioner has reserved 5 minutes for rebuttal.
Good morning, Your Honors. There are three issues we've raised in this appeal that are worthy of the court's attention. I would like to at least begin with what I believe is the broadest and most troubling that reaches beyond the specifics of this case. And that is what we have here is a $200,000 punitive damage award that has been based on the alleged reprehensibility of conduct that did not harm the plaintiff, or in fact did not harm anyone else. A review of the trial record and the lower court's opinion will show that the plaintiff's punitive damage award has been based not on the alleged wrongfulness or malice in the conduct that hurt him, which was getting fired, but in the defendant's alleged malice in conduct that did not hurt anyone, which is putting allegedly unsafe and therefore illegal loads on the highway.
What is the public policy behind the cause of action here?
Oh, the public policy of a Sabine Pilot cause of action is that there should be the only common law cause of action that would, generally speaking, the only reasons you cannot fire someone in Texas are those that are precluded by statute, federal or state. A wrongful discharge action can be based on, under Sabine Pilot, can be based on someone who is fired for refusing to perform an illegal act.
So how, without the punitive damages being a potential consequence, how do you think that we can effectuate the public policy behind the Sabine action cause of action?
Because, the threshold question, as all four dissents noted in the McClendon case, is whether this is a new tort being created by the court, or whether it is a recognition of a cause of action for breach of the employment agreement.
Let me ask you, you argue that a Sabine Pilot claim sounds in contract.
That's correct.
But at-will employment seems to reject the contractual nature of employment. And so how do you reconcile that?
Well, that's not entirely true because there's still a contractual relationship. Someone can always sue for work that he's already performed under the terms of the existing contract. The contract can be terminated by either party at will, but that doesn't mean there's no contract. Someone who's done the work and is then fired can recover for his performance under the contract.
So are you arguing that there's an implied contract in every at-will case?
That's not a matter. That's for services performed. Mm-hmm. It's an oral agreement. Once you've tendered performance to the other side, you have a contractual cause of action for the breach of contract if the other side doesn't compensate you for your performance, even if the contract itself can then be terminated for any future performance. But that's a contractual cause of action.
But that's not what he's suing for here. He's suing for future wages.
That's correct.
And so
I wasn't addressing specifically the claim here.
Right.
The fact is that an employment relationship is a consensual contractual arrangement. It's not a tort between independent people who just are randomly
confronting each other in the course of human events.
But part of that relationship is either party can terminate it for no reason, for good reason, for bad reason, except not for an illegal reason.
That's correct.
So how do we breach a contract if the relationship clearly and unquestionably can be terminated by either party without any damages or obligation, except when it's illegal for an illegal reason? I have a hard time understanding how that is a breach of contract.
Well, because the damages are measured by the breach of contract. I mean, we're not dealing with a personal injury or physical property damage. We're dealing with the non-performance of a contractual relationship, which exists only because the parties have voluntarily consented to be in an employee-employer relationship. So the only damages originate from the fact that that relationship is terminated. This is not what one traditionally regard as a tort. Now, the question, as the McClendon dissent points out, is a fundamental issue, is whether this is a new tort which would impose some kind of duty of fair dealing in an employment relationship, or whether the Sabine Pilot cause of action permits some sort of an implied covenant or cause of action for breach of contract.
Haven't many courts actually recognized it as such?
The Sabine Pilot cause of action as a tort? No, there are no cases actually held that, except the Fifth Circuit, which did in denying the recovery of attorney's fees under reasoning that would just as well preclude the recovery of punitive damages. The same reasoning that the Garcia case used, the whole that you can't, the prevailing plaintiff couldn't recover attorney's fees in a Sabine Pilot cause of action, would just as well apply to a non-recovery of punitive damages, because they said that the most glaring thing is that Sabine Pilot did not say attorney's fees could be recovered. Well, it didn't say punitives could be recovered either. And the court also said that the Texas wrongful death statutes sometimes expressly apply for recovery of attorney's fees, and that'd be pointless if they were inherently recoverable in a wrongful discharge action.
Created this tort to promote the public policy of preventing an employee from being forced to choose between keeping his job and facing criminal liability?
Well, as I described in our reply brief, every time that term has been used, it has just been dicta. There has been no decision in this state in which the decision turned on whether a Sabine Pilot cause of action was a breach of contract or a tort. None of those decisions turned on that distinction. Some of them may have used the term tort, but that's not the point, because they're all dicta. And the point is that the relationship between Mr. Martinez and Seyshred was entirely contractual. It was
sometimes when the legislature creates these causes of action, and they're sort of, we don't know what to call them exactly, sort of quasi-tort, I guess. The legislature prescribes these kinds of damages, but not these, or maybe a full range of damages. Sometimes they allow punitive damages, sometimes they don't. When you recognize a cause of action, if it were a tort under the common law, does a common law court have some sort of authority to limit the damages that would otherwise be recoverable for a tort?
Well, I would imagine they would.
Examples of that?
Well, no. I think the fundamental question is whether this is breach of contract or a tort action. What's a more nuanced question?
So if we were to say it's a tort action, then you lose? Is that what you're saying in this case? If Sabine Pilot is a tort action, then...
Well, if the court believes it's a tort action and that it's and the public policy would be best served by permitting punitive damages, then I presume that we would lose on that point. However, the most troubling part of this case is not really whether a Sabine Pilot cause of action will permit recovery of punitive damages. It's whether a Sabine Pilot cause of action permits recovery of punitive damages for conduct that did not hurt the plaintiff. The malice that is supposedly supporting this $200,000 punitive damage award is not based upon any malice in firing Louis Martinez.
Let me ask you about that. You claim that a finding of malice can't be based on the general danger to the public by putting unsafe loads on the road. But wasn't that the precise type of concern that for public safety that prompted this exception in the first place?
No, it's not. I mean, the public, in fact, Sabine Pilot didn't really involve public safety. It involved a pollution issue. But the fact is that, well, all right. The point is that it has been a fundamental principle in our system for centuries that you cannot sue someone for conduct that did not hurt you. You cannot sue someone for conduct that did not hurt anyone else. You cannot sue someone for conduct that threatened damage to someone.
How did this conduct not hurt Martinez, a person that was fired?
He got fired. The question is, was he fired with malice? The malice, all of the evidence in this record that deals with malice is not that they fired him with malice. This was a good faith disagreement, polite, quiet, business-like disagreement between the employer and Mr. Martinez over whether this load was safely secured. They didn't even raise their voices. There's no defamation. There's no assault. There's no slander. There is no interference with subsequent employment. He was simply let go.
Then what's the disincentive to fire someone for committing an illegal act if the only recovery is actual damages?
Why would that not be sufficient? The fact is that the harm to Mr. Martinez should not be measured by the harm that did not happen to anyone.
Okay, let's go back to my question. What's the disincentive for firing someone for not performing an illegal action if the only recovery is actual damages?
That is a disincentive.
What's the penalty?
That is a disincentive.
Well, actual damages compensate folks for the injury that was caused. What's the penalty?
Well, if you're going to define anything that's not actual damages as a penalty, then there is no penalty.
Well,
but the fact that you have to pay actual damages,
my question.
There is no reason to believe that this is an epidemic problem in Texas, that we have to stop all these employers ordering people doing illegal things. This is something that is a serious social problem that requires an extraordinary measure.
I'm just circling back to Justice Guzman's initial question. On public policy grounds, don't you want a disincentive for firing someone for not committing illegal actions? And actual damages, there's lots of case law in different areas that talk about how actual damages is not a penalty. On public policy grounds, what's the argument against having a penalty to provide a disincentive for this type of conduct?
It might be appropriate if the malice is in the firing. If the conduct that has to be malicious is the firing,
so
the harm that hurt the plaintiff.
Obviously, the jury disagreed with you. Let's say I disagree with you. It seems, reading the record, that there is malice. You don't necessarily you can have malice content by being calm, cool, and collected. You gather your things and get out of here. The result is the same. You don't have to raise your voice. That's not a prerequisite.
Your Honor, there has to be some evidence of the malice that harmed him. And the evidence below, when the trial and the lower court's opinion focused not on the malice in firing him, but the alleged danger created to the public by these unsafe loads that never hurt anyone.
Well, I don't see that in the Court of Appeals opinion. They seem to focus on the definition of malice, which included an offense against the rights of a person. They stressed that, the Court of Appeals majority stressed that several times.
The Court of Appeals seems to be kind of bizarrely obsessed with the fact that the wrong definition of malice was given in this case. However,
but they're focusing on rights. In other words, the definition says, nevertheless, proceeds with conscious indifference to the rights of others.
Right.
And if you have a right not to be fired for refusing to perform an illegal act, then if you don't care about that right, you're consciously indifferent under the definition.
Well, but the problem is that the malice that harmed any alleged malice that harmed Martinez. First, let me address this issue about the definition of malice. The Court of Appeals has overlooked the fact that the question that went to the jury correctly required that the malice of the defendant be in the conduct that harmed the plaintiff. The question was, do you find by clear and convincing evidence that the harm to Luis Martinez III resulted from malice? So how malice itself is defined misses the point. The malice has to be in the conduct that harmed Mr. Martinez. And the only two things the Court of Appeals mentioned were that malice is, that was it, to show this alleged malice in the firing, was that SafeShred's managers allegedly knew that they were telling Martinez to commit illegal acts because he told them the loads were unsafe.
What about, though, this aspect of retaliation? I know that you're arguing that we're an employment at will state and that it is not particularly egregious to get fired. People get fired every day. But what about this retaliation aspect of it? I refuse to carry this load because I consider it unsafe based on my years of hauling loads. And because I wouldn't do that, you fired me. That's retaliation. Isn't there some malice in that, or what aspect of that takes that out of the malice context?
Well, if that were the definition, there would be punitive damages in every case of wrongful discharge, and that's simply not the law and shouldn't be. And there should be something that goes beyond that, some intent, some desire to hurt this plaintiff in particular.
Well, what about the fact that he said that he had one of the employers said that he had abandoned his job?
No, well, what happened was on their internal records, SafeShred wrote it, or on their internal employment records, which were revealed only because there was discovery in this case, the manager had put that Martinez had abandoned his job, which, first of all, is a semantic quibble. And abandoning his job is a perfectly defensible description of Martinez's conduct when he was told to either haul this load that the managers thought were safe or to get in his own truck and go home, and he chose to get in his own truck and go home.
But didn't they also say that he was also ineligible for rehire?
SafeShred was not going to rehire him. That's true.
Even though he was a very good employee.
That's true. Now, does that show malice?
Does it?
No. The fact that someone fires someone and then says, well, we've had a disagreement and we don't want to hire him back because we disagreed with him, it would be difficult to imagine any circumstance in a Sabine pilot cause of action where there wasn't malice, if that is sufficient. I see my time is up.
Are there any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Morgan. The court is ready to hear argument from the respondent.
May it please the court. Mr. Jordan will present argument for the respondent.
May it please the court. In response to the petitioner's arguments and the question from the court, I'd like to focus really on three areas. I know that I may be pulled around to whichever one the court chooses to pull me to, but the ones I'd like to focus on, number one, would be showing that this court should find that a Sabine pilot violation that is committed with malice should support an award of punitive damages. Number two, that the evidence in this case was legally sufficient to find malice in the firing of my client. And number three, that the amount of punitive damages that the court assessed comport with both the U.S. and the Texas Constitution.
Where would the court get its authority to expand this notion of punitive damages here?
The court has the authority, first of all, and I would say not to expand this cause of action, but rather to define the cause of action, because this is a court-created public policy exception to the employment at will doctrine. It was not created by the legislature. It was created over 25 years ago, and in this entire time, the legislature has not sought and has not changed the scope of this cause of action, has not fiddled with it whatsoever. The concurring opinion from Justice Kilgarland clearly set out the types of damages that he believed this cause of action should cover, which included punitive damages. And where the court has established the cause of action and the legislature has not seen fit to come in and attempt to meddle with this cause of action, and I would dare say that it is not only the right but the obligation of this court to define what are the scope of damages that are allowed under this cause of action.
Should we have any concern that if you were to prevail, that it would create a floodgate of this type of litigation?
Absolutely not, Your Honor.
Why is that?
I'll give you an example, Your Honor. I think as practitioners, I think the assumption has been that punitive damages are available. One of the cases cited in my brief, I just looked at it the other day. I didn't even realize it when I was getting ready for oral arguments. The 2010 case, Physio GP Inc. versus Navy case out of the Houston Court of Appeals just last year. That was a case where punitive damages were awarded in that case. I think the assumption has been that punitive damages would be awarded. Certainly, those folks who were looking at the concurrence in Sabine Pilot were assuming that punitive damages would be awarded. And what the concurrence said in Sabine Pilot was that a good model for this court to follow in determining what damages should be allowed is the anti-retaliation statute, where you can't fire someone in retaliation for them filing a workers' compensation act.
Why wouldn't the Whistleblower Act be a good model?
Well, a Whistleblower Act would not be a good model because it specifically defines the type of damages that are recoverable. Now,
that's why it might be a good model.
Well, but here's the difference, Your Honor. What the anti-retaliation statute, all it said is that reasonable damages in this retaliatory discharge case are recoverable. That's all it said. Use that term, reasonable damages. And I dare say that when this court is trying to decide what damages should be recoverable, what in this sort of cause of action, what you're trying to decide is what are the reasonable damages that should be recoverable. And what the court said in the concurrence in Sabine Pilot said, look to what the court did with the anti-retaliation statute. And in the Azar Nutt case and the other cases related to it, what this court decided was that when we're looking at what is a reasonable damage to award when there has been a retaliatory discharge, then we need to have the deterrence of punitive damages.
Would there be, under your argument, punitive damages in every case where an employee is fired for refusing to commit an illegal act?
Absolutely not.
What's the difference? Is it the potential for harm? Or, I mean, what is the court supposed to look at in determining, or a jury for that matter, in determining whether punitive damages should be awarded?
In determining whether punitive damages should be awarded, what needs to be looked at is whether there was malice in the act of firing the individual.
And where's the malice? I'm sorry.
Go ahead. So where's the malice in the act of firing the individual?
The malice in the act of firing the individual, Your Honor, occurs in at least six different areas in this case. And that gets into the legal sufficiency argument, that there was malice in the firing.
Get through your list because there will be questions in between. So what are the six?
There will. Yes. The first area, Your Honor, deals with the fact that there was evidence that Safe Shred's, try saying that 10 times fast, that Safe Shred's managers knew they were trying to force Martinez to commit illegal acts when they terminated him. What the evidence shows, it was flat out admitted in trial. The manager said they knew that it would be illegal to have Martinez drive an unsafe load. And then there was a wealth of evidence from which the jury could draw a firm conviction that the managers, in fact, knew that these loads were unsafe.
Of course it would be illegal to force someone to drive an unsafe load. But the fact is there was, a dispute here about whether this load was really unsafe. And if they did not know it was unsafe at the time they asked him to drive it, then how is that malice?
If they had no evidence or no reasonable basis for believing it was unsafe, then I would absolutely agree with you. However, let's look at what the evidence is. Number one, starting from October 1st all the way through October 17th, Mr. Martinez went to his managers, sometimes multiple managers per load, and told them what was wrong with these loads. Said, look here, you've got this steel stacked up improperly. You don't have anything between these rows of steel that will prevent the steel from falling over.
You don't have an ID number on the cabinet.
That was one thing. Now that one.
How does that risk safety?
That one doesn't affect safety. I absolutely agree with that. Well,
help
perhaps.
Me. As I read your brief, you're quite clear that you say this several times. The conduct that harmed Martinez was his termination.
That was.
And that's how you say, that's why there's so much evidence here of malice, because it was aimed at the termination. But then there's kind of an argument on the side, well, and besides that, his safety was in jeopardy. So it's kind of one foot in, one foot out, seems to me. I mean, are we looking at his safety or just the fact that they terminate him without caring whether his rights are being violated or not?
You're looking at both of them, Your Honor, but respectfully, when you're looking at the issue of whether there was malice in the firing, you're looking purely at the issue of was there malice in the firing. On the other hand, when
regardless of whether his safety was an issue or not.
I'm sorry.
Regardless of the safety issue. Well, it could have been as safe as it could be, but if that was the, if they were trying to fire him for not, for refusing to do an illegal act, that's malice.
No, sir, that in and of itself is not malice. There would have to be a, well, keep in mind that the definition that the court applied in this case did not just involve this specific intent to cause harm, that there was also what was effectively the old gross negligence standards. But that's why this court or this case may not have that wide range of implications, because we're dealing with purely what the definition of malice that the court submitted in this case was. So this holding may be very narrow. But
if he was perfectly safe, do you lose?
No, Your Honor. There was still malice in the firing. And we can,
well, isn't the safety issue irrelevant? Seem like
it. The safety issue is not irrelevant because if, number one, it's not irrelevant in the reprehensibility analysis when you get to the amount of punitive damages, which this court, I believe, has alluded to in the Bennett case, as well as which the U.S. Supreme Court has alluded to in Campbell and in Gore and in the TXO case that are cited in my briefs. But with respect, getting back to the issue of what is the evidence of malice in firing, some of the other evidence, as the court has already pointed out, is that they indicated, falsely indicated, that Mr. Martinez abandoned his job, even though they admitted that he was an excellent employee.
If they wanted to fire him, why didn't they just fire him? I mean, is it? I'm trying to figure out this malice in the firing question as well. I mean, it's not only that did they just fire him, they fired him in the worst possible way, and so that makes it malice. It seems to me that what you're saying is that they were looking for a way to terminate him in a bad way, and they didn't have to, did they?
It doesn't have to be in a bad way, Your Honor. It just has to show either, under the definition the court had in front of it in this case, the trial court had, it either had to be the specific intent to cause harm, or it had to be the gross negligence standard, the disregard for his rights.
Right, but by the same token, you mentioned the evidence that they didn't put things between the loads and they stacked them too high and so forth, but throughout it seems to me that part was disputed, but what was not disputed was the fact that he said the load was too long, and what was their reaction? They called the DPS. They said, you know, we've got this complaint that the load's too long. Is it, here's what it says, and the DPS, oh, no, that's fine, it's okay. And so they satisfy that concern. If that was malice, I mean, how could that sort of evidence would cut the other way, wouldn't it?
Potentially it would. However, the other evidence the court can look at, and which the trial court did, the DPS provided a citation which included the fact that there were cuts on the straps that were used to secure these loads. And those straps continued to be used on all these subsequent loads in direct disregard. Even if the employer did not believe Mr. Martinez and thought he didn't know what he was talking about, certainly I would think they would give some weight to what the DPS citation said.
On the day of the termination, was there evidence that the straps were cut?
Yes, sir.
On that load?
Yes, the straps were the ones that had been cited in the initial, I believe, October, I don't remember the exact date, but it was one of the earlier loads, okay. And those straps continued to be used. On top of that...
Was the driver ticketed? Did Martinez get...
He did. He received a ticket, and when he came back to the office, he gave the ticket to the two managers. I believe it was Mr. Kroll, and I don't recall the
ticket
other.
That he had to pay, or that the...
He did not have to pay that ticket. The company did pay that ticket.
But that related to the numbers on the cab and the registration and lighting and things of that sort.
And the straps. Yes, sir.
And that happened how long before the termination?
I don't recall the exact date. It I believe it was around October the 4th or the 5th. And the actual termination, I think, occurred on October the 17th. I don't recall the specific dates, but they're cited in the brief.
Is there any weight to be given to the fact that sometime after the load did shift and cause some damage to the cab?
Absolutely, Your Honor. And I think in large part that's going to relate to the amount of exemplary damages that were awarded in this case. Because what the U.S. Supreme Court said in the case in the Gore and the Campbell cases is that when, of course, there's no bright line ratio that the court is supposed to follow when it's looking at punitive damages. But there has been some guidance that this court and the U.S. Supreme Court has certainly provided.
And can you expound on that a little bit? Because in Bennett, we certainly have talked about the 4-to-1 ratio. And in this case, it greatly exceeds that number. And so can you talk about that, why we would say that something that's so beyond the 4-to-1 ratio would be okay?
Absolutely. And I was afraid, that being my third argument, I wouldn't be able to get to it, and I appreciate the opportunity to get over to it. The question is, what is the ratio you're supposed to look at? Is it the ratio purely of the actual damages to the punitive damages, or is it what the U.S. Supreme Court said to look at? I would contend it's what the U.S. Supreme Court said to look at in Gore and Campbell. And what they said was that the ratio that's proper to look at is the ratio between the harm or the potential harm to the plaintiff and the punitive damages award. And this gets me back to the justice's question about, well, what about the fact that this load of 20-foot-long steel beams that when the company got somebody a few days later to drive this load, what about the fact that those 20-foot steel long beams came loose from this improperly secured load and crashed through the front window of the cab? Well, the answer, I believe, Your Honor, is that the court needs to take that into account when looking at the potential harm that the U.S. Supreme Court said the court should look at in determining what's the proper ratio. Yes, Your Honor.
I was just going to say, when you get a minute, I've only written down two things on malice, and I think we need to get there before we get there. So can you go back to you said you had six?
Yes, Your Honor. Yes, Your Honor.
But do that, just to follow up to Justice Lehrman's question. Was the shifting due to dunnage or the strap?
That's not in the record, but what we do know in the record, there is evidence that there was no dunnage between the rows, which my client said was a violation.
Don't know if that caused the shifting.
We don't know whether that caused the shifting, but what we obviously do know from the results is that it was an unsafe load.
Now to the list.
Y'all are making this tough on me. The six areas where there was evidence of malice in the firing, Your Honor. Number one, there was evidence that the defendant knew they were trying to force Martinez to commit illegal
counsel,
action. They fired him.
Counsel, why don't we start at three? We've got one and two. Oh, you have a higher probability of getting through your list if you
okay. All right. Sometimes I forget what I've covered. I just did 50 a couple of weeks ago, and my memory is all gone. We've covered the fact they wrote down it was abandoned. There was evidence of the state of mind of the defendants in this case when there was testimony that they found that the plaintiff was insubordinate and obstinate when they were making this decision to fire him. I mean, there was clear testimony as to their state of mind. The fourth item was that they made him ineligible for rehire, which we discussed with Justice Lehrman. The fifth item is that there was a repeated pattern of trying to force Martinez to perform illegal acts that eventually culminated in his termination. There were the events of October the 1st, when they had him drive an illegal load. There were the events of October 8th when they had him drive an illegal load. There were the events of October 9 when they told him to drive an illegal load, but because the DPS had given him a ticket, he said, I'm just not gonna do it. But they attempted still to get him to drive an illegal load. There was the events of October the 15th where at least two different managers told him to drive an illegal load. And then there were the events of October 17th where he drove the load, realized it was swaying so much that it was dangerous. He only drove it about 5 miles and said, there's no way I'm going to drive this. Came back and told the employer, this is dangerous. There's evidence in the record, in fact, that another one of the employees who testified at trial said, I saw the load before he left, And I saw the load when he came back, and you could see a difference in that load.
Well, let's go, but he wasn't fired for all the acts that took place prior. As I understand opposing counsel's position, he wasn't fired for those acts. He didn't have any harm or damage from those acts. He was fired and was damaged because of the firing. And so the malice, his position, as I understand, the malice has to be shown in regard to the firing. And you're saying all of this, all of the prior acts somehow folded into the firing? I thought the firing was because he came back and said, I'm not going to drive the truck. And they said, drive the truck or leave. I mean, your choice.
The firing was because he refused to commit the illegal act of driving the unsafe load.
That was the harm to him, the firing because he chose not to drive the truck.
Well,
how was he harmed otherwise?
I would say it's not because he chose not to drive the truck. I mean, he could have been put in another position.
They gave him a choice, drive the truck or leave.
The firing was
because he would not drive the truck. And the firing was the harm to him. And I understand that. So what is your response to the opposing counsel's argument that you shouldn't punish the employer for other acts that did not result in harm to him?
In determining whether there is malice in an event, you can't just look at an event in a vacuum. You've got to look at what led to that event. Otherwise, how do you know the motive?
Is it your position that all these other factors were contributing to the firing? They contributed to the firing somehow? All these prior incidents, I mean.
I believe they're all relevant to the firing, Your Honor.
All right. Is it your position that any of them contributed to the firing other than his refusal to drive the truck that day?
Well, a jury certainly...
And is there evidence of that?
Yeah, a jury certainly could have found that way because Mr. Martinez kept going to them and saying, this is illegal, I can't do this. And they kept saying...
Okay, and the jury could have found that way based on what evidence? What evidence is there to show that any of the prior acts contributed to his firing, which was the harm that you're claiming?
Well, I believe it would be a reasonable conclusion that the jury could have considered the other events that occurred in determining what was the state of mind and what was the motivation for the defendant in firing Mr. Martinez. Does that answer your question, Your Honor?
They could infer it. I think that's what you're saying. There's no direct evidence, but you're saying the jury could infer that the firing was based in part on the prior incidents.
I think that is a reasonable inference, yes, Your Honor. And I think it's important to look at the circumstances that surround a firing in order to determine whether there was actually malice in that firing or not. I see that my time has expired. I don't know if I appropriately answered Justice Lehrman's question previously, or if...
Justice Lehrman.
Well, I mean, I was really just trying to get... I think you did. I mean, part of my question is, you still didn't answer the part about, you know, we have a 4-to-1 ratio that's been acknowledged, and here you're asking for something so much more than that. And, you know, and so... How do you get around Bennett, you know, where we talked about the total recovery being below the ceiling? I mean, are you saying that could be a factor, the fact that it's below the ceiling? I mean, or, you know, I don't want to put words in your mouth, but what are you saying?
Sure. What I'm saying, Your Honor, is that the ratio to look at in this case is the ratio of punitive damages to the potential harm. The best case I can cite the court to is the U.S. Supreme Court case of TXO Production versus Alliance Resources Corporation. That's a very interesting case. It's one where the U.S. Supreme Court, and it was favorably cited in Gore, what the U.S. Supreme Court said in that case is a punitive damage award of $10 million was constitutional when the actual damage award was only $19,000. It was an oil and gas case that involved slander of title and some fraud claims. And what the court in that case said is that, well, if the defendant had succeeded in what they were trying to do, if they had succeeded, not that they did, but if they did, then the actual damages could have been in the range of maybe $1 million to up to $8.3 million. And so what the court effectively said in that case is they upheld as constitutional a ratio of 526 to 1 of punitive damages to actual damages when the ratio of punitive damages to potential damages was somewhere in the range of 1.2 to 1 to 10 to 1. And if Mr. Martinez had been in that cab when the steel came crashing through the back of it, certainly his potential damages, death, serious brain injury, would have far exceeded the punitive damages of $200,000.
Justice Wainwright.
Your 6 point, counsel.
Okay. Sixth point, Your Honor, was that SafeShred's managers gave false and misleading testimony at trial to avoid the responsibility of their acts in terminating Mr. Martinez, much like what this court focused on in the Bennett case. For instance, Donald Wallace, at trial, he changed his story. He was the president of the company. He changed his story on what Mr. Martinez had said was unsafe on the load versus what he had been saying in his deposition. Quickly changed it. Other examples were Mr. Kroll, a manager there. He, at one point in trial, said there was no dunnage, but he had previously, I'm sorry, he said there was dunnage between the rows, but he had previously admitted there was no dunnage. Mr. Kroll also said, changed his story about what Mr. Martinez had said was unsafe on the loads. Dalton Wallace, the owner of the company, he changed his story about whether he knew DPS regulations or not and how that affected things. There were a few other examples, but those are some of them.
Great. Are there any further questions? Thank you, Mr. Jordan.
An examination of the record will show that none of those alleged false and misleading statements hold up. It's just a sort of cross-examination one normally expects of any witness. For example, Donald Wallace testified at trial that the only thing Martinez said was unsafe about the load was the overhang. Plaintiff's counsel tried to get him to agree he had said differently in his deposition. The witness refused to agree he had said differently in his deposition, and plaintiff's counsel never read the allegedly conflicting deposition testimony. This is not in the record. That's at 3RR23-26. Similarly, Lyndon Kroll testified the two rows of shelving units were pushed together with pallets in the middle. Plaintiff's counsel tried to get him to agree he had said differently in his deposition. The witness refused to agree he had said differently in his deposition, and the plaintiff's counsel never read the allegedly conflicting deposition testimony. It's not in the record.
Counsel, let me switch your focus, if I may.
Yes.
We're talking about malice. Malice was defined in the charge as consistent with the statute, a specific intent to cause substantial injury to Mr. Martinez, or action or omission by the employers, which, when viewed objectively, and there's more language there, involves an extreme degree of risk considering the probability and magnitude of the potential harm to others. There's a risk that the load, the unsafe load, could fall off and potentially injure or kill others on the road, innocent passerbyers or persons in other cars. When we're talking about defining malice, you in your initial comments focused on harm to Martinez.
That's correct.
The charge talked about that or potential harm to others. Why can that harm to others
be question,
considered here?
The question, number three, which is appendix tab 2, page 6 of our brief, actually so question number 3 says, do you find by clear and convincing evidence that the harm to Louis Martinez III resulted from malice attributable to SafeShred Inc.? Now, if the harm to Mr. Martinez had also created risk harm to others, for example, if Mr. Martinez had been injured by one of these loads and that it risks hurting someone else, but no one else risked being fired here. It was Martinez who was fired. There was no, the harm that supports award of punitive damages, the harm that's supporting of malice under the law of the state and under this charge has to be the harm that occurred to the plaintiff.
Okay, so is your point that the actual question to the jury narrowed the charge's definition of malice so that it focused solely on harm to Martinez?
Well, that conduct had to be done with malice. What harmed him had to be done with malice.
Is there ever a situation where punitive damages can be awarded in these Sabine pilot cases?
If, for example, assuming the court reaches the hurdle that this is a tort, if the firing had been a repeated conduct, if they were running illegal goods over the state line and kept firing people who refused to do it and kept sending these illegal loads over the state line, if they were smuggling, for example, drugs, and they kept doing that and people were refusing, there might be.
So it's a degree of it. You're saying it's a degree.
But it has to be.
Excuse me. You're saying
it has to be malice. It has to be repetition in the conduct that hurt the plaintiff.
You're saying it's a degree of illegality that matters?
No, it's not the degree of the illegality. It's the degree of the malice in the firing. If they had harmed him by firing him in a malicious way, for example, if they had slandered him, if they had subsequent employers had called and they said he was fired because he was stealing from them.
So you get one free pass, and if it's more than that, then we look to degree.
No, it has to be malice in the act of firing. If they had assaulted him, if they had defamed him, if they had interfered with his actions to get subsequent employment, if they had done something that was malicious in the act of firing him, as sometimes that occurs in there are cases in this state, for example.
I don't understand how smuggling hurts him.
Well, that was a bad example.
I would think so.
That was a bad example. I was talking about if there was a repeated practice of firing people this way, there might be. But it has to be. You're right, Your Honor. Smuggling wouldn't harm him. But if it were malice in the act of firing him that was demonstrable.
Could you give us an example of that?
Pardon me?
Could you give us an example of that, of what you mean?
Well, there are cases. Yes, there are cases. I can't remember the citation. I think it's in our brief where there was a malicious firing that was held to be an independent tort, where the person was verbally abused in the course of being fired and told to leave and berated in front of fellow workers and slandered and so forth in the course of firing, and that was held to have been an assault, a verbal assault. In fact, there might even have been some physical touching. So that was considered to be an independent tort, and that was malice in the firing. So there can be malice in the act of firing, but this was just a straightforward business transaction where they just said, you either do it what we say, or you go home, and he chose to go home. I see my time is up. Unless the court has any further questions.
Any further questions?
Thank you, counsel. The cause is submitted, and the court will take a brief recess.
All rise.